headlines. Iran's leader emphasizes the importance of strong voter turnout in elections for the sake of effective governance. The Hamas chief says the U.S. and the Israeli regime will not gain through politics what they have failed to achieve through war. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza continues for the 145th day, with the death toll nearing 30,000. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says a strong election, marked by a huge turnout of zealous voters, is one of the pillars of running the country properly. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remark while meeting with first-time voters and martyrs' families. He said that if people show the world that they are present in important and determining events across the nation, they will save the country and help it move forward. He said that everyone should consider the elections in terms of national interest. The leader added voter apathy would not benefit anyone. It rather would deal a blow to everyone. He said refusing to vote would not solve any of the country's problems. The leader made the remarks ahead of parliamentary and the Assembly of Experts elections set to take place on Friday. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hakimi Sagheberia is an academic and political analyst joining us from Tehran. We also have Sam Mahdi Torabi, director of the Resalat Strategic Studies Institute, also joining us from Tehran. Welcome to you both. Let me turn to Sam Mahdi Torabi. Sam Mahdi Torabi, taking a look at the elections in the Islamic Republic, it seems like the international news organizations, if you can call them that in a sense, are in overdrive in trying to discredit Iran and the Iranians in terms of trying to discourage them from going to the polls. Why do you think that they are trying so hard to do that?
You know, we're not surprised. Nothing new. And the reason is because the Iranian people, when they vote, they not only are able to take the destiny of their own country into their own hands, but they actually affect the world when they vote. And what I mean by that, elections in Iran actually matter. They are not like the elections in the U.S., where it's basically billionaires sponsoring, you know, two sides to represent their interests, a Zionist paying both sides to represent their interests. It's actually relevant and has a real effect on the lives of people, not only in Iran, but in the world. And just as an example, we have over 3,500 candidates for the 30 seats that the seats for the Tehran that Tehran has in the Majlis in the Iranian parliament, and they come from very diverse backgrounds. Obviously, no country and no nation is going to allow somebody to run in an election that doesn't agree with the basic constitution and law of the country. And so when Iran does that, like every other country, this is taken as an excuse or as a quote-unquote reason to say that, you know, the elections are not fair, which is a complete lie and a complete distortion of what the reality is. Why does it affect the world? Well, let's just look at history. We had the election that brought about the two Rouhani administrations. That administration accelerated the previously started negotiations with the United States, which ended up in the JCPOA, which was an important matter as it relates to international law and had an effect on the way in which the whole situation as regards the Iranian nuclear file was handled, for example, in the UN. And basically showed the world when the U.S. didn't live up to the agreement, as was predicted by many people in Iran, showed that basically making an agreement with the U.S. and the Europeans is not really that, you know, important because they never live up to it. If we look at the administration that followed when the people voted, the Raisi administration, which is the current administration, it accelerated Iran's entry into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and into the BRICS organization. And many people, many historians, and many analysts of contemporary global affairs have put this as the date in which the new multipolar world was reflected in its institutions. So prior to that, prior to Iran's entry, we had BRICS, we had China, Russia, Brazil, India, being in BRICS, beginning that process, but with the entry of Iran, which was based on the vote of the people voting for an administration that made this one of its main issues in terms of giving the people in Iran the choice whether they want this or another approach, which was followed by the former administration, which was trying to reach some sort of détente with the West. The people voted for this path. So internationally, globally, and domestically, the vote that we have in Iran is extremely important. And contrary to a lot of countries in the West and so-called liberal democracies, it actually has an effect. And it's not simply a game played by elites and moneyed interests and billionaires. And is not simply a facade for their continued rule in their country.
Okay, Ms. Hakimi Saleh-Berria. The statements made by Iran's leader is very telling in terms of just the plain logic of it. And one of the things that he has said is that for the people who are not voting and discouraging others from not going to the polls will hurt themselves. Can you elaborate a little bit more as to the logic that Iran's leader has used for people who either are undecided, maybe, or are reluctant to go to vote, and the effectiveness of it?
Yeah, I think people have to realize that this is a historic. This is something that they are. Their action is significant. Their action has a meaning for Iran's future. Because we are living at a very significant juncture of time, we are living at a time when the global order is reversing, and we are entering an era where Asian countries, including Iran, are going to have an opportunity to build a better future for themselves. And this is at this very juncture of time that we see imperialist powers, especially the Sino-American front, the Zionist regime and the American regime, are actually entering a hyper-imperialist era, a very militaristic way of blocking the will of people around the world. Look at how they are dealing with the will of people in every corner of the world, where they are raising their voice against what is happening in Gaza, and there is no one, on the hyper-imperialist front paying attention to them. And the same thing is happening in Iran, that they are trying to, we have to realize that there are these two fronts are real. These are not imagined fronts. We have a front that wants an independent, strong Iran. And of course, Ayatollah Khamenei is leading that front. And we have another front that wants that to happen, that does not want an independent, strong Iran to basically lead the people, not only the Iranian people, but also the people of the region, and maybe even playing a role in the world, in the whole global south, basically, leading different countries that are tired of this system that is working against the will of the people everywhere. So that is one thing that we have to realize. This is very important, and that is why you see that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, as he is looking at this from that higher point of view, he's looking at it with this bigger picture in mind. It's not that he's sitting in this room of Iran and he's just looking at the scramble of people who are trying to basically be in the parliament or not, but he's actually looking at the past of Iran, what Iran has basically put behind it, and he's looking at what is ahead of Iran. And that is actually the role that the leader of the Islamic Revolution has to play. That role had been played by Imam Khomeini, and it is being played by Ayatollah Khamenei at the time. If you look at the history of how the leaders of the Islamic Revolution have dealt with the vote of the people, this is how they have dealt with it. They have never said vote this way or the other. Basically, there is a sort of calm in their voice that it seems that they are not even worried about which faction is going to basically come to the power, but they are telling the people, come and take the responsibility that is on your shoulder. Come and determine your own, destiny by your own hands. Look at the bigger picture. Look at the way Iran has come. Look at the way ahead and make a decision that this is not a time to sit at home and not vote. It is a time to come and do what is right for the country. So I think that is something that we have to also look at, that over the history of the Islamic Revolution, we have not had one occasion in which Imam Khomeini, did not basically support the vote that the people had given. In every occasion, even when later on we came to know that Imam Khomeini had not voted for this person or that person or this faction or that faction, he had supported the vote of the people, the will of the people, because this is an institution that has to be there, the very institution of elections, which is there based on an Islamic point of view. It's not an imitation of Western democracy, but it is something that has been, taken from the Islamic perspective. The will of the people has to be there, and of course, within that framework of, the Islamic criteria that are there for the people who are going to be candidates for taking office. But of course, on the other front, everyone can participate in basically how the country is going to be run on the part of the parliament. And of course, the parliament is a very key organization, a very key institution in the political system of the Islamic Republic.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Hakimiyat Saleh Birya, academic and political analyst. Also, Sam Mahdi Torabi, director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli regime and the U.S. cannot achieve through politics what they have failed to achieve through war. Addressing a conference in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, by video conferencing, Ismail Haniya added the Tel Aviv regime keeps committing the most heinous crimes against Palestinians. He said residents of Gaza are being killed, starved, and displaced by Israeli forces. Haniya also highlighted the Israeli attacks on hospitals and humanitarian groups. He further lashed out at the U.S. for its complicity in Israeli crimes. However, he underlined that the resistance front will continue to stand firm against Israel's acts of aggression until the occupied territories are liberated. He further praised Palestinians for their resistance against the Israeli occupation. The Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza keeps unfolding as the regime pounds the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest strikes, the regime bombed a residential building in Deir al-Balah, central Gaza Strip, killing at least two children. A similar strike in that area also left a woman dead and many others injured. The regime also fired artillery shells towards areas in southern and central Gaza Strip. The overall death toll now stands at nearly 30,000 since the onslaught began on October 7. Over 70,300 others have been injured. Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from Deir al-Balah, central Gaza Strip, to give us details on the humanitarian situation in the besieged territory.
With the Israeli occupation forces over the last couple of moments actually targeted four residential buildings in Nusayrat refugee camp. Those buildings were completely flattened by the Israeli airstrikes. Scores of the Palestinian casualties actually were reported, and the final number is still unclear as dozens are still trapped and missing under the rubble of those houses. It's worth mentioning that over the last couple of hours, the Israeli artillery intensified its attacks against the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, while in Deir al-Balah city here, The southern part of Deir al-Balah city was subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery. We are talking about continuous air strikes covering the eastern parts and the western parts of Khan Yunis city, where a big fire actually broke out in one building of the Nasser Medical Complex after the Israeli artillery intensified their attacks on the western part of Khan Yunis city. However, in Rafah city, the eastern parts were subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery. Where in Gaza city, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces are still attacking Al-Zaytun neighborhood, leaving more Palestinian, civilians killed and injured. Regarding the humanitarian conditions, the catastrophic humanitarian conditions the people are living here in the Gaza Strip, particularly in Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip, the Director General of Kamal Adwan Hospital announced that Kamal Adwan Hospital will be out of service by tomorrow, as the Israeli occupation forces are still denying them the fuel needed to operate the generators.
The dire living conditions of displaced Palestinians in the southern Gaza city of Rafah have reached a critical point. Access to basic necessities such as food and water has become an extreme challenge amid Israel's recent threat to launch a ground operation in Rafah. Let's take a listen to what people in Rafah had to say about their situation.
We queue up for water and bread. We queue up for everything. What do we do? I have children who need diapers, and the cost for each child is around $8.2 per day. If they want to enter Rafah, welcome.
As you can see, getting food, water, and medicine is an extreme challenge. To get medicine, I've embarked on a very long walk, a quest for sustenance. Accessing medicine and the essentials of life has become exceedingly difficult. We pray to Allah for relief in these matters. Truly, the situation is incredibly tough, and we hope, Allah willing, for peace and safety for everyone across all the cities of the Gaza Strip. May Allah protect us from the horrors of war. About 1.5 million of us are affected, but where to go? What to do? These questions still haunt me. I try to forget, but every time I think about it, I try to erase it from my mind, hoping that things might change and improve for the better, Allah willing.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Members of two Palestinian families have filed a criminal complaint against German leaders for aiding and abetting the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, lawyers acting on behalf of two Palestinian families have requested that German federal prosecutors investigate Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck, Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock and Finance Minister Christian Lindner, among other officials, for providing the Zionist regime with weapons and political support and failing in their obligation to prevent Israel from committing genocidal acts. In a historic ruling in January, the International Court of Justice, ICJ, found that Israel is accused of committing genocide in Gaza and ordered a halt to all its potentially genocidal acts, a decision the Zionist regime has ignored. Lawyers for the Palestinian families said recently, German criminal law requires a ground for initial suspicion to start investigations on a potential crime being committed. The ICJ ruling clearly showed that there is such ground for initial suspicion when it comes to the crime of genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. The lawyer said that Germany has shown some of the strongest political and material support to Israel in its assault on the Gaza Strip and the Palestinians, with many German officials also inciting to genocide in their statements since October 2023. The case is being brought by the European Legal Support Center, PIPD, that is Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy and Law for Palestine, through organizations that are part of the Palestinian-led Justice and Accountability for Palestine initiative. Nora Ragab, one of the plaintiffs, said, "We, the living, must remember the dead in Gaza, tell their stories, and fight for justice. We, Palestinians in the diaspora, will not stand by and watch a genocide being committed against our families and our people. I lost family members in Gaza in November 2023. They were executed by the Israeli military while they were defending their homes," Ragab told a press conference in Berlin recently. German federal prosecutors have a history of shielding accused Israeli war criminals from justice, such as their refusal to properly investigate the Zionist regime's killing of a Palestinian German family in Gaza in 2014. But against the background of the ICJ decision, there may be growing international momentum to finally bring an end to this impunity. In a landmark ruling this month, for instance, a court in the Netherlands ordered the Dutch government to stop sending parts for US-made F-35 warplanes to the Zionist regime. And a federal judge in the United States accepted that the American government was aiding and abetting what he considered genocide in Gaza, but dismissed the case against Biden administration officials over their complicity in these crimes on jurisprudential grounds. Najia Samour, a lawyer on the German case who works for the European Legal Support Center, said, "Our governments in Europe have a legal obligation not to provide Israel any support in perpetrating the current genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. This lawsuit sends a clear message to German officials. You cannot continue to remain accomplices of such crime without consequences. We want accountability." Germany has made no secret of its full support for the Zionist regime's attack on Palestinians in Gaza, justifying Israel's genocidal barbarity and opposing calls for an immediate ceasefire. Chancellor Scholz and Foreign Minister Baerbock gave unqualified early support for the Zionist regime's massive indiscriminate attacks on Palestinians. Scholz, Habeck and Baerbock have invoked the claim of Holocaust as a reason not to oppose the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza, but to actually support it. Baerbock has also spread lies used by the Zionist regime to justify its direct and deliberate attacks on civilians. In its zeal to allow the Zionist regime's extermination in Gaza to proceed unabated, Germany opposed South Africa's application to the International Court of Justice that resulted in January's historic order to Tel Aviv to hold all genocidal acts. That prompted Hague. Genga, the president of Namibia, whose people were the first victims of a German genocide in the early 20th century, to admonish Berlin. Genga, who died in early February, denounced Berlin's shocking decision to reject the morally upright indictment brought forward by South Africa before the International Court of Justice that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Genga said, in light of Germany's inability to draw lessons from its horrific history, the shocking decision to reject the morally upright indictment brought forward by South Africa before the International Court of Justice that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Germany has done more than cheer the Zionist regime's genocide from the sidelines. Between October 7th and early November, Berlin officials approved more than $300 million worth of military sales to Tel Aviv regime. That's 10 times more than Germany's arms sales to Israel for the whole of 2022. In a video posted by the German War Ministry on October 19th, days before the Zionist regime's ground invasion that would dramatically escalate its genocidal violence and destruction, War Minister Boris Pistorius assured his Israeli counterpart, Yoav Gallant, that Berlin would provide the Zionist regime continued military support. Meanwhile, Berlin bragged that it had begun a military airlift to Israel. At Christmas, members of the Luftwaffe, Germany's Air Force, even distributed traditional seasonal cakes to forces of Israel's Golani Brigade. The Germans evidently wanted to reward the Golani forces for perpetrating genocide against starving Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And this all flows from long-standing military cooperation between Berlin and the genocidal regime in Tel Aviv. For instance, the German military has previously boasted that it trains German troops in Israel to use Israeli-built drones that have been tested by killing Palestinians. Since October 7th, the German military has returned at least two of its Israeli-built drones to Israel to allow them to be used in the genocide in Gaza.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma once more. I have the honor to be your host in this program. And then we have Brother Mustafa with us to help us with the topics related to Muslim ladies. So, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam. Happy to be back for these episodes. You know,
thank you very much. Just for those people who have joined us recently, give us a very brief introduction about yourself.
Sure. I'm studying here in the Hawza, and I'm studying psychology as part of my studies. And I've been here for about 6 years.
Yeah. So, Brother Mustafa is an expert in psychology, and he knows about Islamic heritage and the narrations. So he's going to help us to look at Muslim ladies and their topics from the perspective of men.
I'll try my best, yes.
Yeah, thank you for your cooperation. So as for today, we're going to talk about the women as role models. Previously on Muslim Lady, we came to look back at what happened to women historically. Like back in time in the Dark Ages, when the Prophet came, the role of women was that actually they had no role in society, and they were counted as the properties of men. But then the Prophet came, and then the whole story changed. There were some challenging notions to be added to society regarding women. They started to have some respect, some place in society. They started to be considered as individuals in society, of course, gradually. But then it was the starting time, the starting point.
Right.
So right now we come to the role models that have been mentioned in the Holy Book of Quran. Now that the Prophet came,
right,
there must be some role models for women.
Right. And there's so many mentions of different women in the Quran. You know, that also is, I think, a proof or a way to show that how much importance the Prophet and the Quran have placed on women, right? If you didn't see many mentions of, like, you know, role models or ladies or different stories that mention women, you would start thinking maybe there, again, there's no place for women in that. But we see that the Quran is full of different role models, right? And stories which are related to women. For example, we have mother of Hazrat Isa, which is Lady Maryam. You know, we see that she wasn't a prophet, but she was given very much the same level as a prophet. That's
exactly
my sort of own take of it, right? Why do I say that? For example, God says that he chose her and he purified her, right? For a very specific role. We see that she was in a very difficult time, right? People were accusing her of, for example, of doing wrong things, right? We see how she sort of dealt with that. But one of the things that I find really interesting is that, you know, they say that angels descended upon her and would bring her food,
mm-hmm,
right? And then we see Prophet Zakaria, who was her caretaker, when he came in and he saw that food, he was surprised. Right? He was like, where did this food come from? And he was a prophet, right?
Yeah.
So you can see that even though he was a prophet, here Lady Maryam was given sort of this very high status, which was almost even like better than Prophet Zakaria's prophet, right? Angels weren't descending bringing him food, they were bringing Lady Maryam food. And they say, but after this, by the way, once he saw that angels were bringing him food, and after that, he realized, why doesn't he ask God for a son, right? Why didn't he just pray to God for a son? They say that sort of inspired him to do
yeah.
that. So you can see the really significant role that this woman has played and how she's a role model. And, you know, you can dive into much more, for example, how she gave birth and how she went through all of that, how her son, for example, treated her. Those are all really, really sort of amazing examples for us.
Yeah, exactly. Those are so inspirational to tell us about the role models that are mentioned in the Holy Book of Quran. So right now, I guess it's the best time for us to go for a short break, and then we'll be back to have some more of these role models. Welcome back. You're listening to Muslim Lady, and this is Arab English Radio. I am Asma, and Brother Mustafa is in here to help us with the topic of role models for Muslim ladies in the Holy Book of Quran. We talked about Lady Maryam, who actually, according to what we've been talking to, has been treated as a prophet while she was not a prophet. The angels came down to her just as the prophet, with, of course, that of a difference. But then she has got the equality to the prophets.
Yes, another, I think, great example comes in the story of Prophet Moses, right, mm-hmm. of Hazrat Musa. Where I think there's two ladies here which are important, which is one is the mother of the prophet Musa, and then it's Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, who adopted her, right? So from a psychological point of view, it's those verses which are related to the mother of Hazrat Musa are really interesting, right? In the sense of how she felt when she had to sort of give away the baby and put him in the river. We see that God is very accurately describing how she feels in those moments, mm-hmm. and then how he strengthened her heart to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Right? So you see that God is giving examples of the courage of this mother to save her baby, right? And then how she sort of promised that, you know, she'll be able to see her son again.
Exactly, yeah.
So those are just extremely beautiful examples of a mother and how she feels and how God strengthens a mother's heart when the baby, for example, is in danger, right?
So it makes us clear for us that when God is going to pick a person for a mission, for him it does not differ whether it's a woman or a man.
Right, it doesn't matter. It's really important how we all behave in those moments, right?
Yeah.
What's interesting, we don't really hear about Prophet Moses' father, right, in the Quran.
Exactly. The importance is given all to the mother.
I mean, I sometimes wonder, where was he? Like, what was he doing, you know, when all this was happening? Was he alive? Was he not? There's really no mention of him. The whole focus is on
the mother
and the role that she played in getting Hazrat Musa to the point where he was. And then comes in, you know, the Pharaoh's wife, right? Here's another example of, I would say, a woman that was being oppressed, right, because of her beliefs. Yet we see that she persevered through that oppression, right? We have, I think many women can take example from that today. Many women are definitely being oppressed, you know, by their husbands. Their husbands are probably Pharaoh for them, right?
Exactly.
These days. But we see that if you're a believer and you persevere in those moments, then, you know, you're being promised heaven, like Hazrat Asiya was promised heaven in the Quran. And then she also adopted Moses, you know, and how she sort of convinced her husband and how to do that. We see that she didn't, like, you know, she persuaded her husband to be able to do that. A husband that was like killing babies left and right.
Killing all the baby boys. Now the one who's going to be his enemy is being adopted in his lap.
Right. And we can see that she defied her husband's oppression, right?
Yeah.
And for that, she was killed, right, for doing that. But these two ladies, you know, the mother of Prophet Moses and these two ladies were essential in making Hazrat Musa who he was, right?
Exactly.
Being able to bring down the sort of the enemy of the time, the oppressor of the time.
Yeah.
So I think for ladies, those are great examples for us to see today of how you can raise your children to bring down the oppression or the enemy
exactly.
of our time.
And right? Speaking of equity, when you come to see these role models that are mentioned by Allah himself, it makes it perfectly clear that it does not differ whether you are a man or a woman. When God wants you to do something, when he wishes for you to achieve something, he is going to be the one who's going to help you pull through that difficult situation. So Lady Asiya is one of those great examples because, as you just said, she defied her husband, her tyrannical husband, of course, which was not an easy task at that time. And then she became who she is in the Holy Book of Quran.
Right.
So I guess we can keep it in here, go for a short break, and then be back to see the rest.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. Yes, you're listening to Muslim Ladies. We are talking about some role models that have been mentioned in the Holy Book of Quran and that could work as inspirations to all of us Muslim ladies from all around the world. So we talked about the mother of the Prophet Moses and then the Lady Asiya, the one who adopted that son, and then the Pharaoh of her age. And I'm sure still there are some more of examples that are mentioned in the Holy Book.
Definitely. We don't have enough time to go through all of them, but I'll mention some quick ones. We also have some bad examples of women as well,
yeah.
Right? They're not all positive or good examples. We're given examples of how not to be as well.
Exactly. Right? Just like men. We have
just
good
like
examples,
men. Exactly.
We have
exactly.
bad examples.
So they're being treated the same, I would say.
Yeah, to make
right?
it perfectly clear for men and women,
yeah.
who are the good ones and who
There's
are the bad ones.
There's probably way more men in there who are bad in the
yeah.
Quran. Okay, I haven't gone and studied this, but if I were to assume or guess, I would definitely say men are given way more time. Bad men are given way more time in the Quran. But just to give you sort of like a list, you know, and then we'll jump into maybe one of those, is that we have like, for example, the wives of the Prophet himself, the wives of other prophets like Noah and Lot. We have the daughters of Lot who are mentioned, the wife of Imran. We have the wife of Hazrat Ibrahim. We have the wife of Abu Lahab, right? There's so many other places where maybe they're not even mentioned by name, but they're given examples. The one that I really like is the queen of Sheba, Bilqis, who appears in the story of Prophet Sulaiman in Surah Naml. One of my favorite stories of the Quran, right? How Prophet Sulaiman sort of convinces or brings this queen, you know, to heal or he brings her to the correct religion, right?
Yeah.
So in this story, we see that she was a queen of an area and she was a very powerful queen, right? What's interesting in this story, by the way, is that the Prophet Sulaiman didn't know about these people,
mm-hmm.
right? He's informed by a bird about these people, first of all, right?
Yeah.
And then he sends a letter to her, right? He sends a letter to her and he invites her sort of towards the religion of Islam or towards God. And we see that as a woman, how she has advisors that she gets advice from. And she's shown as what's interesting, even though she's mentioned as someone who's worshiping the sun, she's shown as someone who's rational. Someone who's able to think logically, someone
yeah.
who takes advice from others, right? All of these, if we were really going to them, they're psychological factors which point towards how we should be, not only men, but it's also pointing towards women. Look, here's an example of a woman that was maybe on the wrong path, but she used her intelligence and her wits to sort of
To change it all around. Address
the situation, right? The first thing that she does is she sends gifts to Prophet Sulaiman, right?
Mm-hmm.
She says, you know, maybe I can appease him through gifts. And of course, he doesn't need to accept any gifts. Prophet Sulaiman had the whole kingdom. And then she says, okay, look, we'll go and talk to them, right? Let's go and like speak with them. Before we like go to war, let's go and, you know,
shake some sense into their heads.
Yeah, let's have some diplomacy. Let's see what they're thinking. They can see what we're thinking, right? And then we see when she actually finally comes and meets, Prophet Sulaiman, he performs a miracle of bringing her throne. But apart from that, when she's confronted with the palace that Prophet Sulaiman's built, at that point she sort of accepts, you know, that he's the prophet, and
yeah.
she accepts that religion. So for me, that's a great story to highlight how much thinking and pondering and conversation and diplomacy really matter. And we see that a woman was in charge of all of that. She brings her entire like people towards this path, right?
Exactly.
I think that's a great example.
Of course.
Right?
She's going to act as an exemplary paragon for all the women to tell us that it's not just men who could do all these things. I mean, all those people who are searching for equality of men and women, they could go through the examples in the Holy Book of Quran and see how equal they are.
Right.
And this equality, just as you mentioned, is by spirit, not necessarily the physical equality. Okay, thank you, brother, and thank you, dear listeners, dear Muslim ladies from all around the world. This was all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
The British Army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. A leaked document revealed the British Army wants to relax security checks it runs on overseas recruits in an effort to solve the growing staffing crisis. Understood to be the latest guidance, the internal policy document leaked to the British Daily outlines a series of actions that aim to boost falling personnel numbers and cause security clearance the primary barrier to non-UK personnel gaining a commission in the army. Vetting is a standard part of the process of becoming an officer in the British Army and included counter-terrorism checks. Security clearance is described as being the most common type of vetting process and determines that a person's character and personal circumstances are such that they can be trusted to work in a position that involves long-term, frequent, and uncontrolled access to secret assets. The 5-year period being a UK resident needed to gain security clearance was described as prohibitive to overseas recruits applying for officer and intelligence roles. The leaked document noted that the army struggles to attract talent from ethnic minority backgrounds into the officer corps. It said that while people from Commonwealth countries can serve in the British Army, just 135 officers from overseas are currently serving in the British Armed Forces. Of these, just 28 are recorded as being from ethnic minority backgrounds, while the rest are white Irish or white Commonwealth. A group of former army officials have since signed a letter to the UK's Defence Minister Grant Shapps, calling the updated policy dangerous madness. The army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service, outsourcing giant Capita, which is in charge of recruitment for the army, recommended that it should ditch or loosen restrictions on hiring soldiers with tattoos and those with a history of asthma to solve its recruitment crisis. The firm told the Defence Select Committee inquiry into the recruitment of youngsters that many were waiting 150 days to join the army, partly caused by the medical assessments they have to undertake. Its representatives told MPs that would-be recruits were being attracted elsewhere as the time taken to be accepted was so long that they were finding other jobs in the meantime, amid ominous warnings that the Army, Navy and Marines are all hemorrhaging troops faster than they can be recruited. A top US general also warned that the UK's shrinking army is not what it used to be. A former senior US general has said that while the United Kingdom was still seen as America's closest ally, it was also seen as having diminished capabilities over the past couple of decades. They added, "Hence, while being the most important ally across the board, it is decidedly not what it used to be, regrettably. Based on the current trends, the Army will have just 52,000 troops in 10 years' time." In a one-year period up to September of last year, the Army's strength plummeted from 79,139 to 75,983, as more soldiers left than started. The website The Defence Post has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to government figures, almost 30,000 British troops from across the armed forces are medically unfit for combat operations due to physical injuries and mental health issues. The problem is greatest in the Army, where only 53,000 troops out of a total of around 75,000 personnel are currently fully fit for frontline operations. That means that 30% of all troops in the army, or 3 in 10 soldiers, would not be fully fit to fight in a conflict now. The injury crisis will heap further pressure on the new Defence Secretary Grant Shapps, following the disclosure that all 3 services are significantly under strength. According to numbers released by the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, overall, 28,664 personnel across all 3 of the armed forces are currently not fully fit for combat. While some of those could deploy overseas in an emergency as part of a large force, many would not be able to take part in combat missions or even leave a secure base because they have been medically downgraded. Recently, the Defence Post revealed the recruitment crisis is forcing the Royal Navy to decommission 2 warships, Westminster and Argyll, so that the new class of Type 26 frigates can be staffed. According to the Ministry of Defence, the Army is currently composed of around 74,110 personnel, but only 53,192 are fit for operations, or what the military calls medically fully deployable. A Freedom of Information document obtained by this newspaper reveals that 9,217 soldiers are classified as medically limited deployable, meaning that they can deploy on operations but will only be able to conduct certain duties. A further 7,449, almost 1 in 10 of all soldiers, cannot be deployed at all and are classified as medically non-deployable. Comparisons with a number of injured troops from July of 2021 appear to show that the problem is getting worse. In July of 2021, there were 13,248 troops across the armed forces classified as non-deployable, but by July of 2023, the latest figures available showed that the number had grown to 14,743. Further, 7,921 personnel were classed as being of limited deployability. The classification means that they have either a persistent but relatively minor injury, such as a back problem, or an injury that is close to recovery, such as ligament damage. According to government figures, there are 29,220 personnel serving in the Royal Navy and Royal Marines, while a further 29,010 personnel serving in the Royal Air Force. But Ministry of Defence figures show that there are currently just 21,649 fully fit sailors in the Navy, while the Royal Air Force has just 19,466 fit personnel. The Freedom of Information request reveals that across the armed forces, 13,727 troops have been downgraded from frontline duties because of musculoskeletal injuries suffered in training or from combat. But the document also shows 4,214 troops cannot deploy on combat operations because of mental health problems. Meanwhile, the number of troops being treated for orthopedic and spinal injuries under the National Health Service Fast Track Surgery contract has more than doubled in the last 4 years. In 2020-2021, 203 were treated under the scheme, but in 2023-2024, the Ministry of Defence predicts up to 540 personnel will receive fast-track treatment. The recruitment crisis facing the armed forces led Grant Shapps to decide to mothball the amphibious assault ships Albion and Bulwark. It has since emerged that the Royal Marines are currently 600 troops short of their target figure, and the Army and the Royal Navy are also short of personnel, amid claims that the so-called Generation Z is unwilling to join up. According to new figures, Army recruitment has been below target every year for more than a decade. Data uncovered by Labour Party shows that the recruiters signed up 5,560 regular soldiers last year, when their target was 8,220, leaving a gap of 2,660 personnel. In the worst performing year of 2018-2019, there was a deficit of 4,130 troops, with 5,860 soldiers recruited when the army needed as much as 9,990 soldiers.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.